Welcome to this special episode of the Casual Shooters Podcast, your premier podcast for the casual shooter. I'm sure you've heard of double mint gum where you double your pleasure. Well, tonight it's triple mint gum and you're going to triple your pleasure. I've got Todd Weitzel and Alex Mansfield of Manny Talk Shooting on with me. Hey guys, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing, man?
Doing fantastic, Dave. Thanks for having us on.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to go into more of the Hit Factor action shooting rule book. So do you guys think we should start with division first or general?
I can tell you why I put one together if you want to start there.
That's a good place to start, actually.
So real quick, some people have maybe heard me say this before. I've certainly said it on blogs and comments on social media. But so, you know, Scott Ardberg and Frank got booted, you know, around the Christmas holidays. Frank got back on. A lot of people took that more as a more of a call to arms, for lack of a better term. Maybe that's a bad term, actually, but as a call to be more engaged in protesting the BOD. My personal belief was that if you were going to run a Hit Factor match, a Comstock match, whatever you could call it, whatever you want, right, is that I personally think it's disingenuous to run a Hit Factor match and use verbatim the USPSA rulebook for two reasons. One is rerunning their rulebook and just not paying, posting the scores but not paying. Number one is if you ever want to come back from that, you're gonna, I'm assuming, probably have to pay up, right? So you're gonna have some expense in arrears that your club is gonna have to pay. Number two is I wanted to be, and this is Todd's words, better than them. So I am not going to break a bylaw, right? I'm just going to run a Hit Factor match. I'm going to use, in our club, we're going to use our own rules. I'm not breaking any bylaw. I'm not doing anything wrong. The only thing that you could come after our club is for by doing like this is, did we not run enough matches this year? So that was, in my mind, why I thought that we should have a specific rule book for Hit Factor matches. It was just me and me alone, and then visited with some people at the club, at our club. They agreed, visited with some other clubs within Area 3, the Great Plains section match, or Great Plains Hit Factor match now, was the sectional. So Andy Erickson, who you had on your podcast, he agreed. And then Tim Dunduri up in Forest Lake, those guys are running Hit Factor matches, and they're following the same protocol. Some other clubs out there might be using it. You're certainly welcome to if you are of the same belief that I am or others. But that's what preempted creating a specific Hit Factor rulebook.
I appreciate that. And I have two quick follow-up questions before we get into the rules then. One, did you guys reaffiliate with the USPSA? And yeah, if so, are you going to do your mandatory minimum number of matches for this year?
Yes and no. So we reaffiliated, and at this point we do not plan on, at our current schedule does not indicate that we will get our six or seven matches in. I can't remember what it is. Our current plan is we will run an all classifier in May for the people that want to show up and test themselves against what they've been doing. And if eight people show up, and we will offer that to our customers of our club. And that's what we're going to do. So that's where we are. And if we don't hit enough, I guess we'll have to see what the powers that be do to us when we reaffiliate next year.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead, Manny.
And I will say, I do like the fact that, you know, you went out and you made this rule set. You know, you brought up the word disingenuous, and I think it is this is my personal belief, so I'll throw myself under the bus if that's the case, but I do believe it is disingenuous for people to run a USPSA match and not pay the fees without telling your customers first, because they're the ones who, some of these people don't want to protest. Some people just want to come out and shoot, but some of them want that classifier score, even if you're going to run a classifier, right?
Yep.
So, and I appreciate that you made your own rule set instead of just saying, we're not going to pay, because some people do want that. Like, you're going to run a classifier match in May. And that's, I think, the best way about going about it. I like that you're running your own rules. and you came up with a solution that works for everybody. You pay, you service your customer by giving them a good high quality hit factor match, and you still give those people who still want the classifier chase once a year. I mean, it actually works. And then you're not just leading to the, you know, your shooters. It's like, oh yeah, we're, you know, cause I know there's probably clubs out there running hit factor match or USPSA matches and just not going to pay. And then the person who shot that classifier, that's just going to sit there forever and never get paid. They're just kind of sad about it because it gets uploaded, but it doesn't get approved. So then they're looking at it and then they look at the club. It's like, are you ever going to upload this? I didn't know you were protest. You know, the shooter didn't know what they were getting into before they signed up for that match.
Yeah. So, you know, some people out there listening to this podcast might disagree, think we're going too far. How does this help solve the situation? I don't know if it does. Our intent is that our intent behind this rule book was that this does not fix the protest. Mm-hmm. But I think our club feels that we are protesting in the correct way by doing this. I'll speak about our steel challenge side of our club. So our steel challenge shooters, our club was number 3 in the country last year, 1,502 registrations throughout the season. Our steel challenge participants are generally a different group. I've said this before. You have some people that cross between sports. Generally speaking, people don't. There's a little bit of it. Our steel challenge guys really aren't interested. Steel challenge is a classifier sport, so we're going to shoot those. We did change the level 2 match to a level 1, so that is, and we took a couple of our monthly matches and switched into Rimfire Challenge, and we're going to do an outlaw. But generally speaking, it's a very, very, very minor protest in steel challenge versus the USPSA guys.
So, Todd, did those steel challenge matches count towards affiliation?
No, steel challenge is a separate affiliation.
Okay.
So you have a USPSA affiliation and a steel challenge affiliation.
So a club could have just a steel challenge affiliation if they
want. There are clubs out there that are like that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. See, I'm getting educated now. Now other people would be educated.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not going to necessarily get into the politics of things, but you and I, Todd, and maybe it was me and Andy, because you guys are both Area 3, so we talked about some of the same stuff. And I don't remember if it was you or him that said this all ends when they put Scott back on the board. And I don't know if you've heard what Friday night, Ken Cobb put up a Facebook Live. And there was a part in there where he basically said, when Andy gets put on the board, go back and watch it. It's there. Trust me. Because I watched it later. I didn't watch it when it was live. So I was like, wait, what? Stop. Go back. Listen to it again. Basically says when Andy gets put on the board, does that change any protesting in Area 3? Are you aware?
So I would tell you a couple months ago that may have placated some things. And again, these are my opinions, but these are also my opinions that are laced with conversations from other people. So our demands have always been Scott gets back on the board and there's a couple problem area directors that need to go away. It's never been just Scott back on the board.
Okay? That's correct.
I think if Scott got put back on the board right now, and we don't know because they don't release minutes, who the hell knows what they did, right? It's been 2 days already. That is not enough to meet the demand. I think you would see some clubs and some people supporting the Area 3 match, which is has been delaying their registration because they're having troubles getting staff for it. That's been published on the Area 3 Facebook page that, you know, still looking for more staff. I think that would help that match. The local clubs, I don't believe, myself included, that just putting Scott back on is enough. Now, I don't think they're going to put Scott back on anyway. All right. So if they put Andy back on, Andy's a great guy. Everyone in Area 3 supports Andy, but that's still not enough. So I think you'll see protests continue. I don't know how much they'll be muted or not. I'm not sure. Don't think you'll see it stop.
Okay. All right. Well, I think before we get into the actual division, I feel like the better place to start here would be the general rules, and then we can get into the specifics of the divisions.
So I'll tell you quickly how I got started with that, and then you can shoot away.
Okay.
Ignore all the typos in the rule book, because I know there's still some out there. So sitting at home, talking to a few people from our club during the Christmas holiday, agreeing that we should probably put a framework rule set together. We looked at PCSL rule book, because that has a very good rule set that's out there. People, you know, Max has spent a lot of time putting together a sport over the last, you know, couple of years, 3 years, however long he's been working on it. So we started with the PCSL rule book with his blessing. These are not PCSL rules, by the way. We just started with his. We did not want to start with the USPSA rule book. I don't know how you start with it. It's 90 pages or 88 pages long, right?
Yeah, it's big.
So looked at the PCSL rule book. It removed all the 2 and 3 gun stuff, you know, the shotgun stuff, etc., and started altering it to a rule set, both safety, disqualification, you know, all the various parts of the rule set, the targets that can be used, etc., to really come up with something that we thought we could use as a USPSA replacement. And so we really started scrubbing with it. So the starting point of this was the PCSL rulebook. Some of the rules on there are identical, but again, these are not PCSL. But I just want to make sure that, you know, that team, Max and his team, gets credit for us, you know, plagiarizing a lot of
right. And he, if I remember correctly, I mean, he actually said people can use their rules; they don't mind.
Sure,
there's
I just like to give credit where credit is due. Right, somebody spent a lot of time; we should at least give credit for it. So that's how. So really, start scrubbing it, removing the unnecessary stuff. You know, so there's a lot of 2 and 3 gun. Took all that stuff out. Added, obviously, USPSA and IPSC targets, and we can get through that. That's all in there. In addition, you can use a KYL target. Cleaned up some of the disciplinary issues that can happen during the match. Got rid of stage DQs, everything. It's either a match DQ or it's not. So if you have a DQ offense, it's a match DQ, not a stage DQ. And various things like that. And over time, added a couple rules. I'm going to add another one this weekend that a few of us think is a good add as an option, so we can talk through that as we go through it.
Okay. Yeah, when we get there, definitely update us. Okay, it doesn't work.
So,
all right. So my first question was right under at the very beginning, you've got range safety and your basic firearms operations, but I've always been curious, and since I have you on here, I'm going to ask. It all, you know, every book I've ever read was the range is a cold range, but a lot of us also carry. I look, in the military, it was always like, if you're transporting weapons, you are carrying a weapon to safeguard those. And I have the same mentality when I go to a match. I have my stuff in the back. I'm also carrying a firearm. I've always been very careful to make sure, you know, I'm not overtly showing anything. From your perspective as someone who writes these rules and is a match director, what advice would you give to somebody like myself who arrives at the match in the parking lot carrying a firearm?
So, number one, leave it at home, leave it in the car, don't have it on you. Once you step outside that vehicle, right, and your carry gun's on you, it's you go to the safe area or you go to RO and you go to the safe area and make sure you take that out and clear it and put it back in your vehicle.
Even before a foot touches the ground.
Well,
have it on you.
Yeah. In your car, just take it off and put it in your glove box, put it wherever you want to in your car.
Okay.
That's what you want. Now, if you happen to get out and you have it on you, you get an RO, you go to a safe area, you clear it, and then you go back and put it in your car. That's what we mean by cold range.
Okay.
The USPSA rule book actually clearly states exactly what to do. I didn't think I needed to get that far in here because I thought it was frankly just more common sense. I'm not dissuading your question by saying that. I just think, you know, the carry guns stay at home or stay in the vehicle.
Yeah. And I mean, I always leave it in the vehicle, but I usually slide out of my vehicle, take it out, store it in my vehicle, Okay, that's where I was trying to go. Yeah, so that's acceptable.
We just don't want people walking around with a gun that's not being used for the competition, because that gun, what you're using, certainly falls under all the safety rules of the match.
Right. Okay.
And even to outline that too, I mean, we've all probably seen people, you know, at the trunk of the, you know, at the bed of their truck, you know, at some matches that probably should get a stern talking to about it, but they're, you know, muzzling or flagging somebody when they're, because they're not at, you know, the trunk is typically not a safe table either, but we've all had these experiences probably of somebody messing with maybe, not going to pick on you because you shoot maybe PCC or anything, but maybe your PCC or, you know, your carry optics gun or whatever, you know, usually there are those people who do fiddle fart with their guns at their truck, which is typically not the most appropriate place to be actually like muzzling or flagging anybody.
Yeah. I mean, once those stages are set up, that's a cold range. No walking around with guns that aren't, you know, considered safe per the rules.
Gotcha. And it makes sense. Just, I had took an opportunity to ask you that question since I had you.
Yeah. And you can clarify all those things more probably, which is why that's how you end up with a 90 page rule book. But
mm-hmm. Yep. They probably had to at some point and just keeps adding and adding.
Yeah. You could have a 5-page rule book with a 90 page glossary, with every definition of every word.
There you go.
My separate document.
See Appendix B. Yeah. But I mean, it seems like handling of firearms while on the range, all that stuff seems to be what we're all accustomed to. Nothing there.
Nothing loaded there should surprise anybody.
Nope. I agree. Loaded versus unloaded, minimum target engagement, distance for steel targets, 7 yards. All of that seems normal. Now, here was my first real question. Competitor equipment, holster. The holster must be worn by securing to the competitor's belt. And here's my notes that you couldn't see, Todd. I'm sorry. What about, because it specifically says secured to a competitor's belt. What about paddle holsters? Because say someone, like I shoot Canics. I have a bunch of Canics that I shoot. They all come with a paddle holster in the box.
Please tell me
so, you threw them away. What's that?
Please tell me you threw them away.
No, I didn't, but I don't use them. But someone like they're going to a match here using these rules at your range. They just bought one.
Yep.
First match. That's okay.
Well, here's what there's a I'm gonna try to clear this up, and then I will answer your specific question. So way back in the back of this thing, there is the rule book. There's a clause that basically says the range master will make decisions, frankly, based on some common sense. I'm paraphrasing, but what it says. So I would tell you with a paddle holster, I've seen them. I had one when I started. Some of them are very secure. They don't move around. I would leave it up to the range master, MD or RO, whoever, depending on the setup of your match, to say, do they believe that that holster will securely hold that weapon so the gun's not falling off or the holster's not falling out and falling on the ground? And if they believe that that is a safe way to carry that gun, go ahead. If the RO or MD or RM says that they don't believe that that is going to be a safe way to carry that firearm around the range and that they're not allowed to shoot it, then I'm going to let them make that call. So I'm going to make it situational in that case.
Okay. That's a good answer. I like that.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily disqualified, but if it's unsafe for safe gun handling, it's a no-go.
I've had a couple paddle holsters, and I had one I remember that, man, this thing's great. And then I had another one that's just flipping and flopping all around. I mean, I personally wouldn't wanted to have used it, right? And I think you can ascertain that pretty quick, and that's more of a common sense judgment by the officials at the match.
Okay. I like that.
Mm-hmm. And I really like in this holster and probably allied equipment section is the fact that you don't care about how far the gun's away from your side or how low it is. It just has to be attached. I like it's simple.
You
very
know,
exclusive, very inclusive.
It's kind of funny. You know, we just say where the holster's got to be, you know, 2.1.4. that's just to make sure that you're not in a 180 break as soon as you pull the gun out. That's all that's for.
But even that, looking at it, so for people who are just listening, it said the holster must be positioned on the belt between the competitor's 12 and 4 o'clock position for right-handed competitors and 12 and 8 o'clock for left-handed. And again, like Manny was just saying, that simplifies it, and it just says, look, somewhere between your belly button and your right hip is where that gun needs to be on the right side if you're a right-handed shooter. Very simple, very easy to enforce, nothing difficult. I like it.
Yep, that's all there is.
Now we get down to magazines and magazine pouches, and I just had the comment that this was interesting to me because it says, so 2.2 is magazines and magazine pouches. 2.2.1, while recommended, magazine pouches are not required. Competitors may elect to carry magazines on their person, such as in a pocket. Now, what made you include this?
So I'm going to go back to your new guy that just showed up with his Canic paddle holster and didn't know he needed to have mag pouches. You can put a couple mags in his left pocket. If he's
around. Now we're picking on Canic shooters. I get it.
Well, I don't want to exclude anybody. I mean, this is a rare occurrence, but you don't want to exclude anybody that forgot. Maybe they had their holster. I don't know how you'd have your holster without your belt, but you could. We just wanted to exclude anybody. By the way, it's not an unsafe condition. It's just silly. Right? You're not going to have a very fun day, but it's not an unsafe condition.
And it's definitely not going to give you a competitive advantage.
No. You just basically want to say it's okay. That was actually in Max's rule book, that one.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it could be a holdover from multi-gun stuff, because I was thinking about that when we went through it. You know, or I don't maybe have enough room for all my stuff. So if I'm shooting two-gun with PCC, maybe I have a nice belt. Maybe I have a nice pocket on my tactical pants that my 33-round Glock stick goes into, and I'd rather just do that and reach behind. So it's basically allowed. That's all that's saying. That's probably where it came from, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
I have a pair of those pants that, yes, the 33-round Glock mag does fit perfectly and securely.
Have a nice pouch in it?
Yeah, it's like they call it like a knife pocket, essentially. It's, or like maybe like you'd put a flashlight or something in it too, where it's just kind of like a cargo pocket, but there's a slit in the top, perfectly fits that magazine. Yep. Super tactical.
Yep.
So 2.3 is firearm and equipment changes throughout the match. I mean, that's no different than USPSA. Go talk to the range master, let them know what's going on, make your changes.
Just making sure it still fits in the division they were shooting primarily.
Right. Eye protection, totally understand. Ear protection. Now, this one's always gotten me with different match books and things. Ear protection must be worn by each competitor as they're shooting. And it talks about if the ear protection falls out. Now the glasses I get, you could literally lose an eyeball when you're out there. But with hearing, one match isn't going to make you deaf. You know what I mean? And my question is just in general. So this is an education for me as well as the listeners. Are we big brothering people with making sure they're wearing their hearing protection, or is it founded in something different that I'm not thinking about?
I think this is just sometimes you have people in the squad visiting and a guy's got his headset off to the side, standing back, basically just saying, you're not going to bust anybody's balls because they got their hearing protection off when they're not shooting. If they don't care about their hearing, I don't care about their hearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. I do too.
Right. Well, it's valid. Like, you know, a lot of us wear the custom molded ear pro, and you know, you have to pop them sometimes to hear well, because they're really nice. They're made for your ear. So I can see where this is. It's just, yeah, you're going to have those guys in the back of the bay who've got it popped so they can have a conversation without screaming over everybody. Not everyone likes electronics. I mean, I'm personally one of those people. I don't want electronics in my ears. That's just me, though. But I can hear okay. So
I have molded in ear without electronics. And if I'm trying to visit, I pop one of the sides out just about halfway so I can talk.
Mm-hmm.
So. That's all that works.
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, I have to use the electronics because I've been a round gun since I was like 10. And I mean, high power firearm. So my hearing has gone down.
Are you calling my open gun not high power enough for you? It's almost Chris Gelnett loud.
And Chris Gelnett is almost as loud as that Barrett that I used to shoot all the time.
Ooh, let's get into the fun stuff.
Yeah. All right. So divisions. I'm going to skip over this for now, and then we'll come back.
Document. Yep.
Yep. So now we'll go down to match procedures. And I didn't notice anything different than what we're all basically accustomed to.
Now, hold on a second. One thing. Go back up 1 inch, and I'm going to tell you why it's a separate document.
Okay.
We'll get through it later. So the divisions are in a second document, frankly, for ease of editing. So when we talk about the division later, the divisions later, I don't have revolver in mind. But if your club wants to have revolver, take all you got to do is adjust that document to whatever qualifications you want for revolver. And you don't have to go digging through and changing 4.1 to 4.2 to 4.3, et cetera, to do it. So that, just so you know, it's a separate document, for ease of use.
That's very smart. That's somebody thinking ahead. That's what I like. Okay. And I actually have a question about revolver when we get there. So, again, match procedures, everything looks normal coming down. Arbitration of scores and scoring calls minus the $100 fee. No, right. Range inspection and walkthrough. I didn't notice anything different there. That's all the same. I like with the written stage brief, you can add elements in that you want. If you want people to stay within the fault lines, you can write it in. If you want them holding something, if you want them holding a magazine, because I saw that earlier, that you could actually put it in the written stage
brief. You can do whatever you want in your written stage briefing, but some things are going to be cleared out as long as it's a safe action, right? So,
yep.
One of the things in here is from IPSC, which is you can require people to stay within the fault lines. I said this on your last podcast. That would fix a lot of stages that I've seen broken before.
Yep.
Where it's like, man, that would have been a great stage, and this looks like a great stage or whatever it is. And then you see somebody figured out a way to wreck it or crack it, whatever word you want to use. You know, I can see that as being it's certainly a good option for stage designers to use. Mm-hmm. Or even an MD when proofing the stage. You might be walking, you know, people setting up stages at your club, and you walk up to it and you're thinking, you know what, we should make them stay within the fault lines of this one. I don't know if you have to do it to all of them, but I think it's a good option to have.
I think it gives you, now this would be interesting to have Kurt. I talked to Kurt next week. I'll ask him about it, but a field course classifier where everybody has to stay within the fault lines, I think it gives you a better measurement of what the high hit factor would be and the differences with all the different divisions, just because everybody has to do the same thing. It's going to be the same flow, shooting the same targets in the same way and all of that, but give you that field course feel.
Yeah, we're going to add one more in here. I'm going to do it this weekend. There's some typos and stuff to fix in here, but another option that I'm going to clearly line out that you can put in here, because remember, this is in essence outlaw, but it's a framework of rules. But if the protest would happen to go on for an extended period of time, you would hope at some point, maybe you could use something to provide consistency. But the one we're going to add, a few of us talked about, is you can mandate a make change, a reload, during a stage, where you can't do that in USPSA. You know, you can do it on classifiers. And it's frankly going to say you can mandate a reload on a stage if clearly laid out in the written stage briefing after the first shot and before the last shot. Do whatever you want in between it. You've seen people do that before. Our guys did a hit factor carbine match a couple weeks ago, and they did that on one of their stages. And I actually looked at one of the stages we're going to use at the Cornhusker Classic. It's a speed shoot. It's a little 10 or 12 rounder. Which really, with the division capacities that we're trying to mimic, capacity is not a problem anymore in a 10 to 12 round stage, right? But there's a couple quick spots that where you're going to have to change a mag. So I think that's a good differentiator in a speed shoot or maybe another stage. But on a big field course, does mandating Mag change really help? Probably not, because there's generally a spot where you don't have to be good at it to complete the action anyway. So I think having it on a short or a you know, mid-range kind of a course, maybe a 22 rounder, where you could mandate a mag change if you thought it would make the stage interesting, will be a good option for stage designer.
Well, and also 5117 here allows newer clubs who don't have a lot of walls or props to have good stages without being wrecked, right? Like,
yes,
it aids a growing club to be like, please stay within the fault lines. It's like, because they can always game it if you know, they can game it at this point. But now with this, you say, hey, please stay in. You have a great stage.
Yeah, my hope is, frankly, some of these options would be nice back in the USPSA rulebook someday.
Mm-hmm.
To give people options. I think you can make some stages more interesting by giving stage designers some optionality.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't skim that far, but have you thought about, you know, within USPSA's current rule set, they allow that level one exception for you have to activate the target before you can shoot it, like on activators. Have you thought about that, or is that kind of just poor stage design in your opinion, if someone can shoot the activator before activating?
To me, that's very poor stage design.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess you run out of barrels or something, or what? You know what I mean? I don't get it.
Right. The barrel shipment didn't come today.
That was at a Nationals 2020. At Frostproof, the very first stage, the bay they have has that building. And there was a target that would have been activated, and you could go through the house and shoot the target as it was stationary sideways.
You know, I would have just thrown a no-shoot stand in front of the dang thing. I mean, that's easily solvable. So I think it's just bad stage design.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are two things I have highlighted. One was the fault lines, which I like that. I love that. Notes regarding the individual stage design should be in the written stage brief. And I like how you said it is highly recommended. Now, this might be straight from PCSL.
They are. A lot of these comments are just straightly plagiarized.
Okay. But I like it, too, that it's included, but it says it's highly recommended to explicitly list in the written stage brief how many procedural penalties will be assigned for failing to complete the procedures as intended, which I like, because as I read, I don't know if it's further down, but where, you know, if you're completely outside the fault lines, then it would be a procedure for every shoot or every round fired. But like, you know, where people get a foot fault where they're on the fault line, but their toe is touching the ground on the outside, they get a procedural. In that case, would be the same thing. It would just be a single procedure, not one for every shot.
An advantage mindset, right, that the RO has to make a call on.
Right. But I like how it says right there, you can spell it out.
Yeah, I mean, and it's reviewed every one of these and kept everything in here was kept on purpose. So, and the reason that why, and it was written very well, it wasn't changed. The reason why is you'll see people, you know, you have to grab a rope to open up a sliding door, or you have to hold something, whatever it is. Generally speaking, you just need to be very clear what action you are asking somebody to do. So that way you have competitive equity, right? Now you will see people game stuff. Generally, it doesn't help when somebody tries to game something I've found over the years, but I think you just want to be very clear in your written stage briefing of what your expectation is.
Yeah, I like that it prevents it from coming down to somebody's personal interpretation. So,
right.
That's a good thing. Make ready. That's all the same. There's nothing different that I saw there. Are you ready? Stand by. All the same. And then now here's my question to you. This is 5.4. If you're finished, unload, show clear. And I highlighted this because I've had this conversation with a bunch of different people. So I want to get the opinion of both of you on this one. It is the competitor's responsibility to unload their firearms, check to make sure they are clear, and dry fire the firearm in a safe direction downrange. I agree. Now, here's my question. Is it acceptable for the RO to call stop if they see that the competitor is about to pull the trigger on a live round while making clear? The example here, because this happened to me at a match. I was a local match, so I was running the timer, and somebody was shooting a PCC. She forgot to drop the mag, so she ejects the round in the chamber, lets go of the charging handle, drops her mag, and I said, stop. Because I literally saw the round get loaded into the chamber.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I'll tell you where I see it all the time. Let me take your example a little bit differently. So steel challenge, rimfire. Rimfires are notorious for not ejecting, right? So if I don't see that round come out, and the main reason you don't dry fire a rimfire down, people do, but you don't. It's not required, right? So if I don't see the round come out, I'll say, hey, let me see it again. Before they flag or whatever it is. So I don't know how anyone could think it was wrong to say that somebody's about to do something bad and to stop them and to coach them through what they did wrong to, number one, be safe, and number two, they can learn from it, and number three, to continue on with the match.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
If I don't see that round fly out when somebody, and you don't always catch it. The reason why it says competitor's responsibility is, hey, I might miss the fact that you did that, but if I do see an unsafe action, I am going to make sure that we've done one, two, and three.
Right. And we do have those in our sport that do the speed unloads, as I call them, the flipping catchers. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I've ran the timer plenty of times, and you've got the guy who he drops that mag faster than you can, you know, you're starting to spit out words and it's already emptied and they've already put it back in the holster. It's like.
If they've done it fast, I guarantee every RO has at least say, hey, show me again. Mm-hmm. You know, just I've done it several times.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'd rather keep everybody in the match. Like, I even had a friend of mine. We were both working stats, and so the match director and us on stats did a shoot through of the match. And the notorious, I don't understand why this PCC was doing it, but on the last round, for some reason, it would not extract that last bullet that he wanted to unload with. So we'd collect the time and he'd have to shoot it out. And of course then it would fly out, but it was so weird, and we just always had to double check and make sure, but the shooter,
old brass, man.
Yeah. Old PCC brass, Lord have mercy. Well, he blames it because he blames it because it was his father's once fired open brass that he then reused for PCC. It's like, that's probably the problem, but
goodness. Okay. All right. Now, nothing with ranges clear, stop command. I like the coaching and the coachable shooters where people can declare to be coachable. I like that where people can kind of help them through the match. They can't place anywhere, but at least they can, you know, I see this really being more appropriate for a level one, you know, local.
Well, we don't really have levels, so this is.
I know. That's why I said local.
This is all from Max's stuff. I loved it. You know, you guys have all seen people. Hell, we were these people when we showed up at the first one. That having somebody follow me around those first few stages till I got over my initial match one anxiety and nervousness, etc. I think it's good to say that it's okay. And if you want to do it, here's how you do it. I think it's great.
I do too. I think it's awesome that you included that in there.
Actually, there's a typo though. See, it says PCSO match on there.
I see it.
I still have some cleanup to do.
Yeah, right there. It's all good. Bracing on stage props. Now, this is going to be a little bit of a mix of division rules and the general rules because I talked to a lot of people who shoot Bianchi, and I got just interviewed Caleb Giddings not too long ago, and this is one of the things. Now, here's the interesting part that I was like, I did not see anything in the division rules that explicitly denies the use of a Bianchi cup style wing for bracing.
Never even crossed my mind.
I know. If I didn't talk about Bianchi cup as much as I have with people, I would have never crossed mine either.
I guess in enhanced irons and open, in theory, a race holster, you could in theory, mount that to the gun. Open, in essence, says no restrictions. You know, there's a handful of restrictions. So I guess right. you could. I'm not too worried about it. That yeah, rule just... right there that you've highlighted, that's basically the same as USPSA. Is, hey, if part of that wall's in the fault line, yeah, you can lean on it. But if it's not, you can't.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty much standard across the board. Yeah. But that's what made me think of it. I was like, is it really going to help? Probably not. What are the chances of you ever being able to do anything like that? I was like, well, there's a chance, but I could see somebody gaming it.
Yeah, it's like, again, go on there if you want. I don't care what you do.
Right. I keep losing my cursor. Malfunctions all the same. I really like this one that you kept in, Todd, or added. I don't know what it was, but it says under 5.9 is malfunction. So 5.9.3. If a competitor takes longer than 2 minutes to correct any malfunction on the clock, the RO will terminate the course of fire and the stage will be scored. I love that for match flow.
Yeah, yeah, you have to have that there. I think that's pretty common. I think, I don't know what USPSA is, if it says the same thing or not.
It's definitely not worded the same, but yes, it's the same feel, but
yeah.
But it's long enough for you to know that you're done in the stage.
We've all been there. I've had it before. I've made up my mind that I'm done long before 2 minutes.
Yeah. It's nice because it's just an easy, like, all right, it's ticked twice.
we're done now.
Yeah, I had a failure to extract. And after about 30 seconds of fighting it, I was like, all right, I'm done. I just got to get this thing out of here. Yeah. So I'm with you. Squibs, I didn't see anything different there. Now this was a question under squibs 5.10.2.2. If the RO stopped the shooter for a suspected squib and it was found to be clear, they get a reshoot. But it also talks about in there, the shooter can stop themselves if they suspect a squib. Now, if they suspect one, but there isn't one, I assume it gets scored.
Where does it say the shooter can stop themselves?
Where was it? Hold on. If the shooter, right there. If the shooter suspects a squib and does not receive instructions to terminate. So what happens in the same situation with them?
Same thing. If it's found out to be a squib, it's scored a shot. If it's found out to be clear, they get a reshoot. Now, the only caveat you have on this thing, and it's kind of covered later on in disciplinary stuff, is this is the danger you can have with that. Now, number one, mm-hmm. if somebody thinks they truly have a squib, we want them to stop. I think correct. Everybody would agree. We don't want anybody getting hurt, wrecking their gun, etc. This is one of those where somebody could say squib. Now, granted, if there's not one, it's scored a shot, so they hurt themselves. So I don't think somebody could necessarily game their way out of it. So that's why that's there. That was from the PCSL rulebook. I think okay. You don't want anything unsafe to happen on the range. In many cases, the shooter knows it's unsafe as much as the RO does.
Agree. Calibration of steel was good.
I didn't have any questions on that one.
Really? Because I thought it was straightforward.
Dude, Manny, that's a hot topic from last year. You know, the PSA calibration is you got to go get your grandmother's uncle's third cousin to come over and reset it and shoot it 62 times.
I mean, you're not wrong. Like, so I went to a local match here in March and I'm shooting open, right? So very, you know, major power factor ammo. And for some reason, this bullet fragged, and it was a good full diameter hit. It fragged off the side, and it just stood there, and it stared at me. And I was like, are you kidding me? And they're like, well, why didn't you call for calibration? I'm like, one, I don't want to waste everyone else's time for a miss because it's going to go down. It's going to just go down. And I'm like, they're like, but why not? I'm like, it's not worth it. It
goes down 99 out of 100 times.
You lose right. Especially, it's like, I just feel bad because then I'm shooting open and it's just like.
You know. I mean, you got a kink in those things that are holding it up. I talked to several people about that one. I probably spent more time talking to people about that one than anything. We finally said, you know what? If it's a full hit on the calibration zone or the popper or the speed steel and it didn't fall down, reshoot it. Now, if it's outside of there or a partial hit that didn't fall down and you didn't keep shooting at it, it's a miss. I don't know what else to tell you. Now, what maybe could be in there, and it's not, and I don't know how to word everything. What if that person reshoots and it happens again? So now you start worrying about, are they shooting 120 power stuff, right? So you could maybe argue that in a reshoot, if it happens to the same shooter again, is there a different procedure? I'm frankly going to default to the end and leave it up to the range master of the match to say, hey, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to calibrate. So that one might get a 5.11.1.3 to it. just for a major match, frankly, I think you might have to have something there. And the reason why is, what if you're not calibrating? In the Cornhusker Classic, we have typically not done calibration. But at the same time, I trust that most people have checked their ammo and they're running within the spec. But, you know, if you have the same guy going through the whole day getting free reshoots because he's not knocking down steel, I think the RM needs to get involved.
100%. But Todd, this the way it's written takes care of the JJ Rakaza at Nationals issue where he had a full diameter hit in the calibration circle of the popper, but that was where the wind was blowing, so the wind kept the steel up, and when they did the calibration shoot, it fell.
Of course.
But in this case, JJ would have gotten a reshoot. Maybe it changes things, maybe it doesn't. But my point, that's what I like about this. If you have a full diameter hit in the calibration circle, you can get a reshoot. If it's an edge hit or outside of the calibration,
sorry,
you're not. Yeah. Okay. So I like that. It's very simplified.
Well, I'm also a fan of mini poppers only. I don't like full-size poppers. Like, mini poppers will go. If you hit them, they go down. If you don't hit them, they stay up. I mean, it's kind of detrimental because there are clubs that only have big poppers. So then you can't say, well, you can only use minis. But that is from like a match building standpoint or a stage design standpoint. I always design around minis.
We have okay. A lot. We're lucky.
Reshoot seem the normal procedural penalties, foot faults, failures to engage, false start. Targets were fine. Now, would you guys, if you're, let's say you're running a local match, or even what the match you mentioned earlier that's going to be a level one, was it the Cornhusker?
Cornhusker is not a level anything. It's a hit factor major.
So it's a hit factor match. You're using the piece. Let's just say you're going to use PCSL targets. If they put one round in the K zone, does that count as two alphas?
Yes. And that's clear.
I know. I love that.
I don't know if we're going to. I'd like to have a stage where I use them. I personally think a real hoser stage might be fun to use that on just to see who's going to take a chance on shooting one at a piece. One a piece. I don't know. I don't know what the right stage to use it on, but I think it might be fun. Personally, I think it would be fun to mix targets on a stage.
Yes.
I didn't say that because, you know, maybe what you do is you put I should change PCSL. I think he calls them kill targets, KYL targets, where you could have a field course, you know, where you have a couple targets about 35 yards back. You know, you get an alpha mic. Well, if your alpha happens to be a K, you get two alpha. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud, but I'd like to find a stage to use them on.
If you put one of these out at 35 yards and I shot your match, I know for a fact I would be trying to put one round in that K. I would definitely do it.
It's not very big that far out.
It's not, but I would go for it. I would be willing to do it.
The basic reason we just put that in there is clubs already have stacks of varying targets. We didn't want to, per a rule, again, outlaw, you do whatever you want, I guess, but hey, these are the targets, and if you use these, here's how you would score.
I like it. So you've got the USPSA style, you've got IPSC, all of the stuff down here with the hardcover, all the scoring, all spelled out, nothing different there. What is this one? Oh, that's just how they score.
That was in there just to clearly identify what a KYL target, how it scores at.
Now, this is where I was not familiar with the term on the, with the accidental discharge. I'm going to assume our conversation earlier with the PCC, where the guy had to, Manny, you were talking about, where he had to fire the last round in order to eject it. Is that what we mean by burning the round?
Yes. You mean in the case of the PCC, where it wouldn't, where it wouldn't come out?
Yes. Where it wouldn't eject
the round, but whatever it is, that happens a lot in steel challenge. Like I said, with rim fires. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got a new barrel on my 22 rifle and it's about 50-50 right now. It's getting a little better as the chamber clears a little bit, but people always call it burning around. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. We could change the terminology, but I think people know what that means.
Okay.
Basically, all right. Yeah. It's still clear, if clear, and all of a sudden competitor says, hey, it won't come out. Right. So the RO makes sure that we have the time. Go ahead and shoot it into the berm. Bang. Validate it's clear. There you go.
Okay. All right. I like that. Yeah. I just wanted to clarify for me. I was unfamiliar with the term. I'm sure there are plenty of people that are familiar with it. Dropping or unloading. Dropping or losing control of a firearm. That's normal. Flagging and sweeping. Go ahead.
I do have a question. You know, we talk about a loaded firearm here. Is it common practice for, or just normal safety standards if it was like outside of a course of fire, an unloaded firearm, just, you know, the RO picks it up like normal? And
I can't write that. If that's not in here, it should be. I'll write that down and check on it.
Right, because I didn't see anything on. I didn't see anything near where range is clear. And you know, if it was around there, and then it dropped guns. So
that is a good one. I will add that. But you know, because that can happen when you're just walking to the bathroom. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Stay by the gun. Don't touch it. Call an RO.
My favorite phrase is, "I need an adult."
Well, and I actually had that happen at a local match right in front of me. A guy was walking around somebody's, like, you know, those baby strollers that people turn into like PCC gun holders. He was walking by one of those and the handle happened to grab the grip on his pistol and pulled it out of his holster and dropped on the ground and they had to clear the stage and then pick it up. So I assume that's what you're talking about, Manny.
Yeah. I'll make sure that's in there if it's not.
Now, if they drop a loaded gun, I don't see in here, is that a disqualification?
Yes.
Okay. Breaking the 180, that's normal. Unsportsmanlike conduct, yep. Finger inside the trigger guard, they get a warning after that, they get DQ'd. And again, not a stage DQ, but a match DQ.
Right. I do like the fact that it says clearly engage while clearly not engaging targets, right? Now with all of our snow fence walls, everyone can say, well, I was engaging that target. It's like, how? There's no possible way you would be engaging that target. There was no need for your finger in that trigger well.
Chronograph just basically says the match directors, you know, they can have Chrono if they want.
So at Chrono, are you going to have Chrono at the Cornhusker Classic?
No.
You heard it here first, folks.
We don't really have a place to do it, frankly.
Right. And that's the nice thing. Like, even, you know, in USPSA, you didn't have to have it at a level two because not every place can have one.
We'd have to give up a stage. So,
yeah, no one wants you to give up a stage for waiting 20 minutes to pull my bullet and tell me if I'm okay or not, or have them. Which is interesting, is I still don't understand how range officials shoot the chronograph still. I really don't.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing on 11, you see 11.1.2, video evidence is allowed.
Yes.
Doesn't mean it'll help you, but it is
allowed. And it cannot hurt you.
Correct. You can't, the RM can't use a video to see if you had a foot fault or not, and then go out and see, oh, and by the way, I watched it and you broke 180. You can only use video to look at a call that was made.
11.2.2, video evidence that is submitted for judgment on a specific scoring penalty, or disqualification dispute will never be used to implicate the shooter of an unrelated infraction, no matter how serious.
Yep, it's only against the call that was made.
And there's your catch-all right there, Todd, that you mentioned earlier. 11.3. Any situation not specifically addressed in the rulebook shall be up to the RM to issue a fair and thoughtful ruling, or the arbitration committee if one has been established.
Yep, and that's right from the Max's rulebook.
I like it. All right, so
I do have a question on video evidence. Is it, you know, with is there going to be like a time limit on when a competitor can use video evidence for to get a calling made? Is it got to be before the squad leaves the bay? Or is it just has to be before final scores are posted?
You know, I don't know. What do you think we should put in there?
Before final scores are posted,
right now, Manny. What do you want?
I mean, at least before final scores would be nice. But I'm also understanding from a match flow perspective, you know, your stats guys collecting tablets and then you'd hate to have it at the end where you've got to spend an hour on this video evidence when it's not fresh in anyone's brain, but you're looking at all this video and then you don't get to go home at the end of the day because you're now looking at video. So I can understand where it's before your squad leaves this bay, get a hold of the range master and show them the video, and then we can get it fixed right then and there. I don't know, 50-50 on that one.
You know, I probably will just put a clause in here that says this, you know, disputing of the infraction, et cetera, must be done timely with the match staff.
There you go.
And that's probably about all you can do.
Could you put something in that just says before you fire your last round of the match, once you fire your last round, you cannot?
I mean, most infractions like this where somebody say they have a video, it's probably going to be a 180 break or a foot fault. Right. Because mm-hmm. you're not going to catch a shot on video. So those are probably the likeliest two. Mm-hmm. Those are probably going to be challenged very quickly.
Yep.
Yeah, true.
The RM is probably going to be over there within 2 or 3 minutes, probably before the competitor gets their mags reloaded for the next stage. It's likely going to happen very quick.
Well, and right after I said what I said, I realized how dumb it was, because what if it's the last stage of the day and that was your last round?
I think generally speaking, it's going to happen really fast. I think the problem people are going to have if anybody ever tries to use video is, you know, where they standing. That's the problem where I think, you know, say video evidence is allowed in like a national level event. You'd have to calibrate that camera so it was perfectly perpendicular to the 180. It's tough. I think it's probably pretty clear, egregious 180 breaks you're going to be able to see. Foot faults, depending on where you are standing in the course of fire. If you're way up and there's a wall in front of you, you're not going to see it, right? So I don't know how much it'll help, but I have seen instances on Instagram where I think video evidence may have confirmed a ruling, which I think is not necessarily a bad thing either, to confirm that it's right, because you're really just looking at getting the right call. And then I think everybody can just move on from it. And you've had all the evidence that was available to you at your disposal. But it's kind of like the NFL, or right? So it's got to be indisputable evidence to, you know, to reverse the call. And are you going to get that from an iPhone? I have no idea. It'll happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, and this is another interesting reason of why everyone should go to a Skycam. Like, I got this idea from Dave, you know, Chris Gelnett with the Skycam, right? You can see the whole state, especially if you put it in the middle of the back of the bay. You're going to get a nice angle, and you can see a lot of things. You're not going to see everything because wall props or whatever, body blocking the camera, but it definitely does help instead of the guy with the iPhone in the corner of the bay like this, like, yeah, no, bro, you didn't ever break it. And then the angle's horrible for as it is.
Yeah.
All right, now for the fun one, the divisional rules.
Yes.
All right. Open.
Yes, you can use your TTI combat.
I'm actually not going to be getting one, but I had to put that in there. I thought that was funny.
Oh, you're not.
So what would be the purpose of someone declaring minor?
Just because the gun doesn't qualify in any other divisions and their ammunition and firearm don't make major.
So we're talking about a match that doesn't have a chrono then?
No, you might have somebody that shows up with a Glock with a compensator on it. you're going open. I don't care if it's iron sights, it's an open gun. Right.
I gotcha.
I mean, that's the number one thing. You see guys show up with these Glocks with a little compensator on the end, and they either don't want to take it off or they can't, you know, it's red Loctite on the end of it for some reason. Guess what? You're shooting open.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like the, let's use that Canic TTI Combat. You can take the compensator off in the end, but the barrel's ported, so you're still going to be an open.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So now my question on this one though was the race holster.
Yeah.
And I for some reason I'm thinking IPSC allows quote unquote race holsters in all divisions. So was there ever any consideration to just allow those type of holsters in all divisions?
No. So here the premise behind these divisions, generally speaking, was to frankly ensure that people that had taken the time to invest in their current rig, their firearm, their setup and everything, in most cases clearly mapped to a division in the Hit Factor rule book. That was really the main reason behind it. Right. Mm-hmm. So trying to mimic in most cases USPSA divisions because that's what people have invested in and trying to keep it as like as we could.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is a completely differentiation from PCSL. Max and I talked about, right? So Max is not trying to be USPSA 2.0. He's trying to create a different sport. So he has different divisions. And so, you know, what we're trying to do here is to mimic that. You can see this evolving and growing. If this would happen for some reason, go on for a long time, I can see people making changes to it. But that's one of the basic premises behind the divisions here. Mm-hmm. Now, a clearly funny one, this is what I mentioned way on earlier, where there was a funny one, and I did put it in. See number 6 under there? That's the first question somebody asked way back in December. Well, if I have a PCC with a pistol brace, isn't that just a pistol? No, it's not.
Well, and I actually have that question down in the PCC section.
Well, we'll ask that, but just so you know, that's why that's there. No,
that's
a
funny.
PCC with a pistol brace is not a pistol.
Well, when it comes to this too, is I love the fact that there is major scoring because you know, Todd, you and I both shoot open division in you know, with handguns, right? And we have guns that some guns in open won't run minor power factor. I'm very fortunate.
If I change the spring, it will. And it'll run like dog shit.
I mean, I'm very lucky. My gun, for how it's set up, I can run, you know, like sub major, but not bottom feeder minor. It'll run in my gun, which is awesome for practice because I save a hell of a lot of money, but it's nice because I'm not disincentivized from shooting open division in Hit Factor. Where in like PCSL, Max is catering to a different market. They don't necessarily have the fancy $6,000 race gun. They just have their rules and they don't care about major minor,
yep.
But I appreciate that my major gun is still loved.
Yes, it is loved.
But Alex, I'm going to ask you, let's say there was only one scoring factor, like we'll just say minor. Let's say all scoring was minor, regardless of division. Don't you think you still have an advantage using an open gun because of the way it cycles and you've got a slide ride dot and all of that? I mean, a frame mounted dot.
I guess let me answer it this way. As I would, if the sport was only minor only, I would still shoot it. But with there's so many good shooters out there, I don't think between an open gun and a carry optics or an enhanced optics or whatever you want to call it gun, there's not much difference. I mean, yes, there's some mechanical advantage of having the frame mount, but shooter skill is going to come out at the end of the day. And I like that I'm in my own little category, but I really, you know, at the end of the day, most local matches, you're fighting for the top anyway, versus whatever, it doesn't matter what division you're in. So I like that it's got its own little field, but I wouldn't feel heartened, you know, disheartened. Like I know Kurt McKenna, who does I'm drawing a blank to what his rule set is called.
I don't remember right off the top of my head either.
That was my biggest thing, was like, well, where does an open gun fit? Because we have all these people who have these open guns. And there was,
and keep in mind, your participation rate in opens like 22% or something last time I checked. It's in that range. So, and 95% of are probably running major. So you're disenfranchising a decent portion of your shooting base by not having this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Based on the early numbers, that number is dropping significantly with limited optics.
Yep.
Well, we also it's also April now, but as soon as more majors roll out, I think your numbers will, we'll see how the numbers change even in June. I'm going to be curious how the numbers rotate a little bit.
Well, I've already been looking at the next two majors, which have like 250 to 350 shooters each, and it seems to be marching out. But I don't want to put the numbers out early and be wrong. That's why I'm waiting.
But I already see a clarification I need to make in 8 right there. Right, that's, you know, single action only guns must have a manual safety before starting the stage. And then it should say if it's a loaded start, right? Those are the little
things
that have to be put in there,
right? All right,
let's skip enhanced optics and practical optics. We'll do those last.
Okay.
So enhanced irons. I'll just say before you ask me a question, is the equivalent of limited.
Yes, that's what I assumed. And again, my comment was just like the last one. I guess it's you're only really declaring if there's chronograph.
Yeah, no, you're not asking.
The Otherwise, it's caliber.
I thought you or Manny might ask a question here. It doesn't say that you have to be 40 to be major. Not that anybody's got 9mm major running in enhanced irons, but if you
will give them major. I will hand you some major. I'm a jerk at local matches. I'm like, how much will it cost for you to run this mag through your gun? And they're like, what is it? Oh, you already know what it is. And they're like, no. I'm like, darn it.
I don't think too many people are running that with a necessarily have a gun that can run 9mm, but it doesn't say you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's probably a few steel framed guns out there that'd be okay, but the polymer guns would not do well with that.
No.
Not good at all. So that's all I had there. So that's what I assumed, that was limited, but you can shoot up to 45 with it.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's because there's no single stack either, keep in mind.
Right.
At least not in mine. You can have it at your club if you'd like. Let's skip this one and let's get back to the optics divisions last because those are the big differentiations.
Okay. Practical iron. So here's your production.
That's production. Yep.
Yep. Okay. PCC, I did put on there. Well, actually, there's two. Okay. So 3 and 4. Pistol braced carbines not allowed. Coupled, meaning side by side magazines. Are prohibited. What was the purpose of those two?
If you're going to have to reload, you need to come from either your belt or from your tactical pants pocket that we talked about earlier.
Okay.
To me, that's too much of an advantage. That's you got to reach away from the gun and do a reload. That's just the reason there. Now, pistol brace, carbine's not allowed. You could take that out. I guess I don't. This is maybe one where you're babysitting too much. There's various laws out there, and I don't necessarily feel that I want to condone somebody doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. Right. So we could take that out. I frankly don't think a pistol brace is, you get the same purchase on your shoulder as you do with a regular brace.
I agree.
That's just my opinion. But if you want to run this at your club and you wanted to change that rule out, to strike number 3 away, mm-hmm. away you go.
All right. Now, so I'm going to go ahead, Manny.
I did have a question. We, on 11 of practical irons, I'm going to back up just a slight bit. It says hammer down, right. Start position required. Now, is that fully decocked or what about half cock? What are your opinions on that, Todd?
To me, hammer down's all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
I could clarify that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the way down. I want to make sure that firing pin was all the way.
Now, what made you go with the 15 plus 1 capacity on that?
That's the same mimics USPSA.
Okay.
Again, it mimics USPSA. So people have probably been training. You have people that are shooting both disciplines, USPSA and outlaw slash hit factor, whatever you want to call it. So some consistency. Now this last piece right here, I know you have a couple questions. So carry gun, you could have whatever you wanted in here, right? So we'll get back to the two contentious divisions in a second. But if your club wants revolver, you know, you can either shoot open, or we could change the rules a little bit to allow you to maybe shoot in practical irons. We could probably change it to that. I think if you had enough revolver shooters, I think you'd be better off just creating a division for it. You know, just creating the same qualifiers that place the gun in its correct division. That's what I would do. Or single stack. I left them out because at our clubs, we just don't see much participation at all in it. It's usually none. Right. And our club shoots I-Corps, so there's plenty of opportunities there. But if we feel that we need to add them, we'll add them. And if your club feels that you need to add revolver or single stack, 1911, carry gun. Carry gun is a PCSL division that has stipulations on what a carry gun is. I think this is just basically if your club wants to add a division because of your participation or not to leave somebody out, this is your place to make those adjustments, and which is why the divisions are in a separate document.
All right. So revolver, I had, would revolver fit in practical irons or practical optics if you were to put an optic on your revolver now? Is there anything that would preclude them from competing in those divisions?
You know, I don't know if there actually is. I think you would have to clarify a couple of the points in it. You'd be at obviously a significant disadvantage, right?
You would.
But we just left it out. Frankly, the way it's currently written, a revolver would likely have to go to open. And
that's an even more significant.
Yeah, single stack would have to go to enhanced irons, which is in essence limited.
Okay. Well, and I would think if I were a revolver shooter, I'd rather shoot in practical irons or practical optics over open, because that's an even more significant disadvantage.
Yeah, so, I mean, nobody's asked me. A couple people say that their clubs have quite a few revolver shooters. I would just add the division, and I would put the qualifications in there and make revolver a division. Mm-hmm. Nothing to preclude you from doing it at all.
Gotcha.
Probably should be in there. I just didn't originally.
Todd, and okay. Do you see any revolvers at your Steel Challenge matches?
Oh, at Steel Challenge you do. Mm-hmm. There's much more revolvers in Steel Challenge than there are in hit factor shooting. Mm-hmm. Now, our club runs I-Corps matches, and I think they're becoming more popular across the country, if you've ever shot one.
My club actually hosts, we have one of the top five GMs in the nation, Alex Bakken, he at our club up here in Michigan, and he is on the I-Corps board, and he runs our I-Corps matches, but attendance is not very great on them, because we're in the middle of nowhere, but still...
I-Corps matches get like 20 people.
Well, that's probably about 15 more people than ours do.
They shoot the tombstones.
Well, here's the cool part, right? Like, and they're at least to this I-Corps matches, they will set up, they have USPSA set up on that day. They'll put up the I-Corps targets out there and let them shoot I-Corps, tear those targets down, and then they put the USPSA targets up the next morning for the match.
Yeah.
Or the hit factor. Anyway, yeah. But it's cool.
So anyway, the divisions, we'll get to the contentious ones now, or the big change here in a second. But right. You know, if you want to add revolver to your club, add revolver. I mean, you know, do whatever you think you need to. Now, the big change with divisions, frankly, is practical optics and enhanced optics, which is in essence limited optics and carry optics. But this makes a big differentiation between those. Talk to several people about it, and the consensus that we had was that practical optics, i.e. carry optics, frankly, when it started, really was supposed to be production with a red dot. I think everybody agreed that was the intent behind carry optics. Mm-hmm. So this fixes that. So if you go down the page, practical optics is exactly that. It's 15 plus one. You have to have a red dot mounted says where to mount it. No compensators reporting, no thumb rests, you know, flashlight, same there, everything. So it's basically your production / practical iron gun with a red dot, same capacity. Your enhanced optics is really a combination of limited optics. And if you want to load up your carry optics rig with your 141 millimeter bag stuffed with 23 or 24 rounds or however many you can get in with these fancy followers now, you can put your magwell back on the gun. You can use a race holster if you want. And that's what that is. So it kind of splits carry optics between your choice if you want to be capacity limited or not. And obviously, a single action, slide ride gun obviously falls into enhanced optics, like limited optics would be.
Right. And I highlighted race holsters are allowed in enhanced optics.
They are.
Yeah. So, okay.
So that's now probably the biggest difference. So you've taken the biggest division, right? 50, 60%, maybe more, however it's trending in USPSA match with the carry optics division, and it's fundamentally changes it. Practical optics is what carry optics was supposed to be, and enhanced optics is the single action guns. You know, a lot of people are shooting Shadow 2s. I know that's not the only one, but you know, the fact that you have a double action on your first pull, you don't have to, right? You can put your safety on and have it cocked in enhanced optics if you want to start that way. So.
Okay, so practical optics, the biggest discussion I wanted to have here was, and this is because I have a gun that has a magwell, and that is the magwell. I'm just going to drop that over top because, oh, shoot, why did that do that? Oh, you know what? Let me just stop this. There we go. All right. So this is my carry gun that's on the screen, but I'm going to show it as well. It is unloaded. Whoop. So it technically has a magwell, and with my virtual background, it doesn't want to show it, but you can see it in the pictures there. I've used it in competition and I've run it in open because I'm not, even though I've read the rules and I think it fits the definition of being small enough that it's not considered a magwell, I wanted to get your opinion. So these are the measurements that I took. The outer lips are only 1/8 of an inch in size, in width. And the top I got 0.16, so about 1/6 of an inch. Would that tiny little magwell disqualify somebody from production optics?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a magwell. To me, that's a magwell. I know it's small.
I don't like
it. It ain't helping you much, but that's a magwell.
We can't be friends anymore.
Here's the main reason you have to say it. Do I think that little tiny thing is advantageous to you? Sure doesn't look like it.
It's not.
But Here's the problem with the divisions and all that stuff. Keep in mind, this is hopefully just a placeholder rule set that people use for the reasons stated very early, right away at the beginning of the conversation. Is if I want to do that, now I have to write specifications, and that also means I have to check it, which is why there isn't weights in here. So if there's weights in here, that infers that I'm going to weigh them, right? Now, so if you would happen to require this rule set for an extended period of time, you are going to have to do some of those things, right? You're going to have to get a box. You're probably going to have to weigh the guns, et cetera. If I write a rule in there that says that your magwell is only so big, that implies I'm going to go measure it, right? So the easiest answer to say, is that a magwell? It's clearly a magwell, and it's clearly not allowed. Therefore, that gun is open or enhanced optics.
So load up the mags.
Load it up.
Put a bigger magwell on it.
Or take the magwell off.
Right. Yeah, I'm not taking it off.
So, Dave doesn't have the thing up. No worry about it. But Practical Optics, you know, says number 8, thumb rest not allowed. What when it comes to those CZ slide stop replacements, and I would agree that it is a thumb rest, but people would then argue it's my slide stop.
You know, that is one that's on my list this weekend to clean up. So I'll tell you my belief, my opinion, and what I will write in here. Mm-hmm. Is I'm going to likely write in the same rule that's in the USPSA rulebook. Okay. Just because I don't want to necessarily, my goal is not to have people change their equipment. My personal opinion is that the two practical divisions should not be allowed at all. There should be no thumb device allowed whatsoever. That's just Todd's opinion. But I'm going to change this, actually mimic what people likely already have because it's allowed.
Makes sense.
So. It does.
And then you don't want to nitpick somebody, be like, well, that, you know, that's not okay. But and then they go to see Joe Blow's gun, but that's okay in the same division. It's like, rage quit. Flip the chessboard. Yeet.
Unsportsmanlike conduct.
Well, wait, is it unsportsmanlike if I pick up all the chess pieces though?
You know, here's the problem. So for the practical optics thing is, you know, people got these giant thumb rests now on their carry optics rigs like it's an open gun. Mm-hmm. And
yep.
Anybody that sees it obviously knows that it's allowed within the rules, but you obviously, I think a lot of people have the opinion that that's probably shouldn't be allowed, but the rule's not clarified enough. So I don't know the right answer for it. I don't know. I'm just going to mimic what people have. I think the big goal of the divisions, which is to say that, hey, there's a difference between a capacity constrained red dot gun with a red dot on it, which USPSA does not have today, right? So you do not have a capacity restrained gun in USPSA today. And in these rules, you do. You have practical optics.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
Let me see how many people for the Cornhusker Classic are signed up just between those two. Last time I checked.
Ooh, look at that. We're getting some insider information.
Yeah, that's no secret.
Now, typically, how many is max capacity for the Cornhusker Classic on attendance?
150.
Okay.
We're about 125 right now.
I'm assuming it's staff shoots one day and a competitor shoot on like Saturday or Sunday. What?
So before I lose that though, so Enhanced Optics is 52 entries and Practical Optics, which is the 15 round constrained, is 22 people. There's 22 entries in it. So it's actually, people understand the difference. So staff shoots Saturday, and we have ROs to RO the ROs, if that makes sense. We tried that last year, and we're great for us. I know some other clubs do it. Kind of makes the field, the staff, that they kind of get their own chance at a match without having to do everything themselves. And we're going to do that again. And then Sunday is the main competitor set. We do have one squad on Saturdays for Saturday competitors. We have quite a few, you know, you have people that have work conflicts. They might be firemen or whatever it is in their day off. We want to make sure they have a chance. We also have some people that observe the Sabbath and they can't shoot on Sundays, so they have a chance to come and shoot Saturday.
Gotcha.
Now, Todd, why is it that on practice score, I can't see the breakdown of the different divisions that people have signed up for?
Oh, you have to have admin access to your club in order to see that.
You are just mean. More, there's so much mean coming out of you tonight.
Alex, you're an admin on practice score, aren't you? Yeah, you have to be an admin to see the breakdown of a match.
I can go to other, like I can go right now. I'll do it, actually. I can go to the Delmarva.
Oh, no one wants to go shoot Delmarva.
No, but I can go there, I can click on it, and when I click match breakdown, limited has 26, open has 60, production 11, carry optics 132, limited optics 80. You see what I mean? Like I can see it in other matches. Do you guys just not open that up to be visible to outside people?
I don't think so. I'm looking at all the matches that I'm signed up for that I'm not an admin and I can't see what you're seeing.
Oh, are you on the outside page, Dave? Like, so if you pull up the Cornhusker Classic Hit Factor Championship by Ben Steger Pro Shop, there's the option right above Hit Factor Level 1. It says View Squatting, but below that it says Match Breakdown. Are you hitting that button?
Yeah, I'm hitting the View Breakdown. Same thing I did with the Delmarva.
And I can see there's 24 in open, 52 in enhanced, 10 in enhanced irons.
On the Match Breakdown?
Mm-hmm. And I'm not an admin.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Sorry. Why Dave's IP has been blocked.
You're right. The Match Breakdown, it does that. And it's in so we, you know, obviously there's no classes in there. So on our registration, it says if you happen to be classified in a similar shooting sport, please enter what that classification is here.
Yeah, I cannot see the breakdown of the different divisions that people have signed up for. Interesting. Sorry. I can't see the squatting either.
Really?
It's got to be something on your computer, though. That's really interesting now.
2024 Cornhusker Classic. Well, it says classes. Hit Factor Match. Oh, you know what? That says, why does that say shirts? Let me go back.
Oh, he's in the shirt link.
Yeah, I clicked on the first one that said Cornhusker. The shirts.
You're in the wrong match.
Oh, there it is. Whew.
Well, you can order a shirt while you're in there.
I guess I should have read the entire title.
Yeah, but the problem is I can't pick it up. Can I have it delivered for free?
You
can
have it shipped to you.
There you go.
Extra but Todd, those numbers still, even though they're reversed per se, that's 74 out of you said 120. It's you're still talking 60%.
Yep, totally.
So that's about what Carry Optics and Limited Optics are running, but the numbers are reversed, with Carry Optics being higher than Limited Optics.
Yes.
But not by much. I think I've been running at about 33%, 34% are Carry Optics, and then about 22 is Limited Optics, and that's where I get my 56. Between 55 and 57% is what I'm seeing.
Yeah, it's about 18% open here so far.
Yep. Yeah, open's dropped, I want to say like, I'd have to pull up my numbers, but like 15% in USPSA, they've dropped a little bit. So, all right, cool. Yeah. Practical iron. So your production, you have 9 folks. PCC, yep. 5. Okay.
It's a red dot world.
It is. It really is.
123 entries and 19 guns are iron sights.
Yeah, it's crazy.
People need to hurry up and get on this match. There's only 27 slots left. Fill it up.
Yep.
Yeah, they usually kind of fills up about a month before. So we'll see.
And then, oh, yeah, June 8th. Yeah, you got plenty of time still. Well, those are all the questions I had, Todd. Manny, did we cover everything you wanted to talk about?
I think so. I think I've got everything. We came up in an organic conversation, so it's good there.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to see the rules, they'll be updated this weekend with some clarifications that I've been keeping notes of. And so on my Instagram profile, there's a link up there that'll take you to the rule set.
All right. Well, guys, I appreciate you both coming on and chatting about this so we could talk about it in greater depth.
You bet. Anytime. If anybody out there wants to reach out to me, with ideas and maybe some clarifications, feel free to send me a message, because I am all for crowdsourcing and fixing stuff as needed.
There you go. There's their opportunity.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Thanks, Alex.
Until next time.
Don't be a little bitch.
Yeah.